Blog Talk Radio.
This is Art and Soul Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Art and Soul Radio. I'm your host, Leslie Riley of Artist Success, and it's Monday, September 10th, 2012. I'm coming to you from our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., and my guest today is Daniela Wolf, encaustic artist and author with a textile sensibility. A big hello to all Art and Soul Radio fans, and an even bigger welcome to those joining us for the first time. Thank you all so much for listening and spreading the word about the in-depth artist interviews here at Art and Soul Radio, where you can find their answer to the eternal question, where does art come from? Art and Soul Radio is brought to you by Art and Soul, the National Art Retreat. For more information on workshops, instructors, and locations, please visit their website at artandsoulretreat.com. You can always listen to any of these shows on the Blog Talk Radio show website, but even better, subscribe to us on iTunes at Art and Soul Radio Podcast. Download them to your iPod, iPhone, or iPad for inspiration on the go. So let's get this show started. Daniela Wolf brings a textile sensibility to the ancient medium of encaustic, merging these two disciplines and using a limited choice of materials to create newly formed language. Her art background includes fiber, collage, jewelry, and metalsmithing, as well as sculpture. A 2008 Rydell Visual Arts Fellow, Danielle's encaustic work has been exhibited at the Cleveland Museum of Art, Pittsburgh Center for the Arts, and internationally at the British Craft Center in London. She also has an extensive resume as a sculptural textile artist. Danielle teaches popular encaustic workshops and writes the blog Encausticopolis about all things wax. She's authored two books, Encaustic with a Textile Sensibility in 2010, and the Encaustic Studio, a wax workshop in mixed media art, out just this year. And there's a DVD included with that book, plus she has another separate DVD. So what more could you want except Daniela in person? Well, I've got her here today, so let's get started. So hello, Daniela. Welcome to Art and Soul Radio.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to finally talk to you. I've been admiring your work for quite some time, especially anything that has the word textile in it, but then when you combine it with encaustic, it's just wow. So I'm excited to hear what you have to say today.
Great, thank you.
Okay, now, one thing I read about you, and I really envy, is that you grew up with a father who owned a Hollywood prop house. So what a
right.
gold mine for inspiration that must have been.
Oh, I'm telling you.
Yeah. When did you realize you were going to be an artist?
Oh, I don't think I had a chance. It just kind of is in our DNA. And, well, it's a funny story how we got to L.A. and Hollywood and to be in the movie biz. Can I tell you that part?
Please do, yeah.
Okay. So many, many years ago, my grandparents on my dad's side were living in the Lower East Side of New York on Broome Street. They had a little deli grocery store, and they lived upstairs like many immigrants. And my aunt, my father's sister, the oldest sibling, my aunt Sid, fell in love with a guy who was a movie producer in Los Angeles. And he asked for her hand in marriage to my grandfather. And my grandfather said, yes, you can marry her, but you have to take the whole family to L.A. So he did. And so consequently, the whole family got to be in the movie business, you know, more of the behind the camera scene than in front of the camera scene.
Right. What year was
Although,
that?
That was about 1918,
1919.
Yeah.
Whoa.
And so in 1919, my father, who has been 16 years old, was shipping cameras at the 20th Century Fox studio in Los Angeles. And the whole family, my grandparents became extras in the movies.
Uh-huh.
And my father found that schlepping cameras was really hard physical work, and that if he worked in the prop department of the studio, he would have more regular hours and he wouldn't have to do such heavy lifting. So
mm-hmm.
he started working in the prop department, and then he started working for an independent prop house, and then many years later he started his own prop house. And so I grew up in this milieu where, you know, I would sit at my dad's desk, and on top of the desk were all these books, history books, books about history of ornament, styles of ornament, antiques, furniture, blah, blah, blah. And my dad was really into the research part of stuff. So lots of art directors or set decorators would come in and say, you know, I'm doing this general store and I need this, this, and this. And my father would say, well, this hasn't been invented yet, so you can't use this. Or you can't use that telephone, or you can only use this light fixture or whatever. And so I grew up hanging out and playing in this huge warehouse with light fixtures, wagon wheels, Kachina dolls, Navajo rugs, baskets, general store stuff, furniture, oil paintings, everything floor to ceiling. And just that was sort of my playground when I would go into Daddy's store, Daddy's work.
Oh, I can't imagine.
And we would also, when we traveled, we'd always go to antique stores or auctions. And my father would say, don't say you like anything when you go into the antique store because they'll jack up the price, you know. And I would always get excited and say, oh, Daddy, could we have this, you know.
Yeah.
So, and we also, Disney was our client as well. And I went to opening day at Disneyland, and that was 1955. So, and I would always see my little art projects on movie, you know, in movies and the nightstands and little Disney kid movies and stuff like that. So, it was a kind of a different childhood.
Definitely. You were making the magic behind the scenes for, oh, that's so fabulous. So why didn't you continue on in the family business?
Well, I did give it a try, and I did styling for TV commercials and stuff, but my dad's business was more like stay there and work with set designers, but I wanted to actually do the set design or do the design work. And we also went to a lot of musical theater and theater in general. And I was really enamored with set design and stage design and how the set would turn and move. And I remember seeing Oliver at a really young age and watching how the rotation of the stage would make a room change into something completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And something about human scale in relationship to architecture or art or fantasy sets, I think, really got me to thinking about scale and work, artwork in relationship to human form. And I've just always liked to work really large.
Right. Okay. That all makes sense now, definitely. Because to me, working large is, there's just so many mechanics behind it, I would think, to work on a scale
mm-hmm.
that large. So it's never been something I was even interested in. But coming from your background, I can see where you just think big naturally in that way. So that's really eye-opening for me.
Exactly.
So then I guess, did you do set design? Did you end up doing that?
some, when I was in grad school, I did some pieces that were more like for set design or dance theater.
Mm-hmm.
But just more, we called them environments in those days. Now you call them installations. But
right,
I have
okay.
done a little bit of theater design, but more it's been in the art genre, not so much theater.
Right. Okay, so you've done many, 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 many large installations. I'm guessing primarily in fiber because you, I believe you started out as a fiber artist, but now you're known as the encaustic gypsy. So when did these encaustics enter the picture and who deemed you the gypsy?
Oh, well, let's see. Encaustics came into the picture in 2001. We had bought a house on Whidbey Island, and
mm-hmm.
we were in the spring. We bought this house up there, and we were visiting in October, and we were in a little teeny gallery viewing a Day of the Dead show, and I saw these two encaustic paintings on the wall, and I was drawn to them like a magnet, and something primal happened to me, and they had the surface which sort of looked like skin, and they had some text in them, and they had some flower, like sunflower petals dried in the surface, and I was just like, what is this, and how do you do it?
Right.
And the artist was there, and I don't know what she said, but what I heard was beeswax and an iron. So I ran home, no beeswax. I found a candle, a paraffin candle, which I lit, and I started dripping it, dripping the wax on paper. And then I took an iron, a steam iron, and I just ironed it, which caused a lot of smoke, which I now know is really toxic and really terrible. And then I found out that there was one book at that time called The Art of Encaustic Painting, which I got.
Mm-hmm.
And devoured. And then I found out there was this company, an encaustic paint company called R&F Paint, and that they gave workshops in regional cities. So I signed up in San Francisco, which was my nearest one, and I took the class in February of 2002 at the Center for the Book, and I was in love. And because I had worked, I've actually worked in a lot of media even before the fiber. I started as in ceramics, went to jewelry and metal smithing, and then found fiber while I was at Haystack, which is a wonderful school in Maine. I was in the jewelry lab and went to a talk one night by Walter Nottingham, who totally seduced me into the world of fiber by wrapping my entire head with different colored yarn. And
really?
That was the end of me. So I've always been kind of a materials junkie.
Uh-huh.
And I have found, it's been 10 years now since I've been working in encaustic, and I've found that encaustic is the glue that holds everything together for me and, you know, other mixed media, textile, and you name it, it's pretty much no holds barred. There are only a few hard and fast rules, and even those can be broken.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's just completely magical. There are a couple of words that you need to know. One is rigid and porous.
Mm-hmm.
Wax likes really porous surfaces.
Right.
So shiny paper and shiny magazines or coated stocks don't work that well. Sometimes the wax doesn't like to stick to it, but you can then sand those surfaces and make them porous or not so slippery. And then we break the rule about rigid by, I work on in paper a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Okay, yeah, because I always wondered about fabric and encaustics because most people work on board or talk about rigid surfaces. So that's why I was so keen to talk to you about textiles and fabric and paper and encaustics. So,
yes, and I've worked with a number of textile people who, you know, just wanted to work with fabric. And we make armatures, we form fabric around stones or whatever's available. And, you know, you can get it very sculptural by simply dipping fabric in medium. And then once it's coated with medium, which is encaustic medium, is a combination of Damar resin and beeswax, you can then do all kinds of things with it. You can do transfers, gold leaf. You know, it's just, you can collage with it, you can cast with it. It's just amazing the amount of variety that you can achieve with encaustic.
Yeah, and you mentioned that it's the glue, and it does, so it is literally like a glue. It adheres things, but it also seems to me, listening to you, to be like the, what's the word I'm looking for, like the mother of all art materials, I guess.
Well, I think it is. And, you know, on the RNF website, they have a description of what is encaustic, and they say it's the most versatile of any 21st century medium, that you can scratch it, sculpt it, paint it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are about, you know, 15 things that it will do. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing. And this notion of the glue is pretty terrific because right now I'm doing a series of hot, on the hot palette collages that are sort of large. And you can, what we call juice up the palette with medium, put paper down, and then start collaging many, many layers of paper. And then pull this collage off of a hot palette and everything sticks. And then if you don't like where you place something, you can just put it right back down on this hot palette and rearrange things. And there's no glue that I know of that can do that for you, where you can just completely reactivate the surface and change. And I'm going to be doing a demo of this at the Encaustic Conference in San Antonio in September. I think it's the first week in September. So any of your listeners who are in that area, come on down.
Yeah, that sounds really good. I wish I could come on down.
Yeah,
maybe at some point I'll be in one of your classrooms. Now, you mentioned you said you were working a bit larger, and you mentioned the hot palette. So that brings me back to my question about size. Now, some of the scale of your earlier work was as large as 22 by, dare I say, 400 feet. And you were quoted as saying that you need miles, pounds of this, which is, again, beyond my comprehension.
Okay, that was a project for public TV in L.A. for KCET for their 28 Tonight show. And just last night I put on Pinterest a board called Earlier Work, and you can see that piece, a couple of shots of that piece on my Pinterest site. So that was a project that I worked with an art director on, and eight IATSE union stagehands. Uh-huh. And we used 10,000 yards of burlap, which worked into 22 feet high by 400 running feet. So I taught these stagehand people to weave, and we did actually four different genres. We did weaving, crocheted, knotted, and tied structures out of burlap. And so we did them in 2 and 4 foot width until we had the 400 running feet, so that everything was modular and could come off a 22-foot pipe. And, yeah.
Yeah,
big
that
project.
Makes better sense then. Okay. So, but then the encaustic works that you're doing appear to be on a much smaller scale. So is that by design or mechanics or desire? And what do you lose by working small, and what do you gain?
Well, I'm actually working pretty large with my – well, I'm doing large and small. Let's just put it that way.
Okay.
And I work on panels, cradled panels. I work anywhere from 8 by 8 inches all the way up to 36 by 36 inches. Some of my larger panel pieces are 18 by 80 inches.
Oh, wow.
But a lot of the work that I'm doing now, you mentioned just checking in your questions that I mm-hmm. read. That is 8 by 8 feet, which maybe is a lot smaller than 22 by 400 feet.
Right.
So I guess it is kind of tiny. But what I'm really interested in right now are the things that are becoming artifacts of our society, like my mother's checks or my checks, like mm-hmm. The tickets that they dispense at a shoe repair store where they write on how they're going to fix those shoes. There is a piece that is traveling in a show called Paper Cuts right now, called A Few of Her Favorite Things, where I bought 4x6-inch cards that were an inventory of a woman's tchotchke collection over her lifetime. I got this at an estate sale.
That's wonderful.
Or mom's recipes, or there's so many things. I have two pieces right now with library due date cards that my library is getting rid of. So I'm really interested in kind of doing these little archaeological or pieces that are reminiscent of what we used to have and what we don't have now, or they're becoming extinct.
Right, they are.
And I kind of miss that stuff, you know? Like having a calendar on my iPad or my iPhone or my Mac, and just, you know, it doesn't do the same thing for me that my paper calendar does for me.
Right.
That I like to write in pencil on, and I like to have it with me, that I can feel it, you know. And
right.
So,
I'm with you on that, definitely.
But then those things become fodder for me. You know, I'll just sew those things up and put wax over them and fold them into boats, or I'll make them into these totemic giant pieces that are showing of the hand of me or whoever wrote these tickets out or whatever, some human interaction, you know.
Right.
No cyber stuff. And
okay.
People seem to really respond to them. They look at them, and they stand there, and they read them, and they get all engrossed. It's pretty funny.
Yeah, I think that's that curiosity, too, about what other people have to say or write or things like that, too. But it does draw people in, definitely. Now, you mentioned Just Checking, the series you were working on. So tell us more about that.
Okay, so after my mom died, may she rest in peace, this was 2003, I became the container, the holder of her things. And my dad had died some 15 years before that. And when your parents pass, there's something about the things that they wrote on or that they had become a treasure to me anyway, like my mom's checks and like my family's Rolodex and just family documents and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to be in a show It was about recycling, and it was at a bank. And I thought, oh, my gosh, how great would this be if I could do a piece for the bank that were that was my mom's checks. So, and my mom also was meticulous about balancing her checkbook every month and writing on the envelope when she bounced it and, you know, like that. And so I took all the checks. I put them in order. I mean, this is so OCD.
Yeah, I don't think anybody would have noticed if they weren't.
And I think, you know, pretty much you got to have some OCD if you're going to be an artist. It just goes with the turf, and a little ADD too, you know.
Right.
Anyway, I started sewing the checks in their whole form, and then I started cutting out her signature and just doing rows of her signature, which was mind-boggling because there was such a regularity to the signature. It was the same. Every looked the same in every single one of them. And then I would cut out the bank number, and then I would cut out the squiggly line part. And so each one of these six-foot strips was the same deal. You know, it was like a line of signatures, a line of bank numbers, a line of her squiggly lines. And I just love that kind of compulsive craziness. And it was just, you know, it was kind of an homage to mom, too, you know.
Right, for sure.
Because you took so much care with your finances, I want to honor you for doing that in my own way, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's where Just Checking came from.
All right. And then more of your mother's papers. You used her recipe cards, which turned up as a project in your book. So
right.
I fell in love with that one, too. I just like the piecing look, I guess, is what attracted me to that. But more importantly.
Very quilty.
Yeah, exactly. Just the whole construction of it. But then you mentioned your method for displaying artwork like that. And I was giddy with the excitement to hear that method. So would you explain that and tell us, did you come up with it or how?
Are we talking about the magnets now?
Yeah, we're talking about the magnet.
Yes, I did not invent this. There's a wonderful sheet that we hand out in the R&F classes. I now teach also for R&F Paints. And there is a sheet in there called, in the literature that we have, called Presentation Techniques for Works on Paper. And my favorite one of those is using a flathead screw, which you screw into the wall, and leave maybe an inch or two of space between the wall and the end of the screw. And then we have these very, very tiny 5 or 6 millimeter diameter magnets that you put on the other side. You put the screw in the wall, you put your paper artwork up against those screws that are in the wall, and then you put a magnet on the front side of your work. And they are very, very strong, and they hold up, they can hold up a lot of paper. And it's very, very discreet. The white of the wall on the gallery usually is white. Makes the translucency of the paper kind of come through, or you can put a light behind it. And it's a wonderful way of displaying artwork. It's easy, it's fast, it's inexpensive, and it's very effective. And it's my favorite way of hanging works on paper.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful, because I like that fact, you know, the idea that it's not contained or constrained by anything else. It's just there as itself.
Right.
Oh, I love it.
Right.
I would love to see. Do you have any on your website or anywhere, any photos of work installed that way?
Most of the works on paper are installed that way, but you don't get to see that fitting. I'll tell you where we demonstrate it is on, I have a DVD with my two partners from Waxworks West called Encaustic Plus Paper, and we demonstrate how to hang those, you know, it's a video.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if I do mention it in depth in the book.
Yeah, I didn't see any more information, so I was, for some reason, I latched on to that, that little detail in there. It's like, whoa, wait a minute, I've never heard of this, so that was exciting.
And as a resource for those magnets, it's called teachersource.com,
okay.
Which I think the S is common, there aren't two S's, teachersource.com
okay.
for those magnets.
That's great. All right, well, then back to the actual artwork then. I read that you take an annual retreat at your Whidbey Island home where you develop a vocabulary each year for your artwork. So explain that to us.
Well, I like to put things into what I call a container so that I make parameters with which I work. And so I think what I'm referring to as my vocabulary is one year my assignment that I dreamt up for myself was white paper, black pens, and two shredders. So one would be a cross-cut shredder and one would be just a regular long shredder. Mm-hmm. And so I journaled. I do this practice called the art, the morning pages, which is from The Artist's Way. And so I would do my journaling every morning, three pages, longhand, and I would use a different black pen every day so that sometimes I use, you know, like a little skinny uniball, sometimes I use a brush, and everything in between. And I would shred those journals up and put them in plastic bags. So that I could look at what did my handwriting look like with this pen, with this pen, with this pen, and what did it look like shred cross cut, and what did it look like shred long cut. So that's what I'm talking about when I'm saying I built a vocabulary of what did my handwriting look like by using all those simple different nibs, you know, gauges of nibs, if you will. And then I could use that work almost as a different kind of a language, you know, which was of really of mark making.
Right.
That looks like language, but you can't really tell. It's got that revealed and concealed thing that so many of us think is so fabulous.
Yes, it is. Did that come, that your use of your handwriting, you mentioned your mother's handwriting and how uniform her signature was that at all inspired this container that formed?
No, I think that piece, that black and white piece, was done way before my mom passed.
Okay, so it's just something you've been fascinated with for a long time, handwriting and signature and mark making.
Definitely, text is almost always evident in my work.
Okay. All right. In your book, which is called The Encaustic Studio, A Wax Workshop in Mixed Media Art, you say that encaustic is a dream come true for mixed media artists. Now, we've alluded to the fact that you can put anything together with encaustic, but what specifically about mixed media is your book directed towards mixed media artists?
I think it's the versatility of the medium. Like I was saying earlier, you know, you can scratch it, you can sculpt it, you can paint it, you can cast it, you can do almost anything with it. And in the 10 years that I've been working in it and teaching it, I get so much back and inspiration from my students that, mm-hmm. you know, it's like I go, why didn't I think of that? You know, I show
right.
them, you know, things that I've figured out, and then they'll take it another step further, another step further, another step further. So I am generally kind of a fickle person, and I'll swing like Tarzan from one medium to the next to the next. But with this one, I found I don't have to do that because of the versatility of the medium. So you can do it 2D. You can do it 3D. You can do a combination. You can go forward. You can go backward. It's incredibly forgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no other medium that I know that will do the things that this medium will do. And I just think it is the most perfect mixed media medium that there is. Unless
okay.
somebody can
you
turn
sold
you on
me.
Something else.
Yeah. Now, one thing you mentioned earlier about the project you were doing with different pieces of paper and layering them, you said you were working on a hot palette. So does
right.
that come in different sizes? I mean, let's talk about materials here. What
okay,
what do
sure.
you need
well,
to create larger work?
I'm not sure if you know or not, but I have two partners, Wendy and Judy, who are sisters, and we have a school called Waxworks West. Say that
okay.
three times fast. and we are on the Monterey Bay in a little town called Corralitos. And we teach encaustic about twice a month, the three of us. And we also have guest instructors come. And Wendy and Judy's brother is a guy who's very handy, builds cars and all kinds of things, knows all about materials. And he builds palettes for us that are, as far as I know, they're the largest in the industry. And so our largest palette, hot palette, is 18 by 36 inches with a brush rest on either end. And so they are, and then we also make small ones, smaller ones, 18 by 18, 12 by 18, and we make custom sizes.
Okay.
So we can do really huge work at Waxworks in the studio on these huge palettes. But for people who are starting out, the pancake griddle will work just as well. It's small, but all you need is a flat thermometer or a laser thermometer to make sure your temperature is right and safe,
mm-hmm.
within safe ranges.
Okay, now, if I, as a textile artist, just want to work with fabric, what
mm-hmm.
supplies would I need? Because I know there's a lot of quilters that listen to this show, too, and cloth people. So what would I need to start with?
Well, I do recommend a palette and with a thermometer, because if you want to work with fabric that is flat or do constructions with fabric, it's really good to have a palette. I also recommend some kind of receptacle, maybe an electrical skillet that you can put your medium in, that you can dunk fabric in.
Mm-hmm.
You need gloves. We use nitrile gloves, and we have heat gloves, terry heat gloves as well. Brushes that are natural bristle.
Okay.
We also have some really great tools like encaustic irons, heat guns, torches, and we have a tool that is like the ultimate jaunting. It's like a hot wax stylus pen that has
mm-hmm.
different attachments where you can write on the wax. You can use the wax like in a batiki kind of a way.
Right.
You can sculpt with it, with the iron. You can make divots in it and backfill it. So, you know, for a basic setup, I would say either a hot palette or a like a pancake griddle and an electric skillet. And you need a candy thermometer or a laser thermometer because temperature is very, very important in encaustic. It sounds like, oh, it's very, very benign. What's more natural than beeswax? Well, if it burns, it's not so good to have in our lungs.
Okay.
So we always stress either a candy thermometer in liquid beeswax and or a laser thermometer for that purpose or for a palette. There are also flat thermometers that not quite as accurate as a laser thermometer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the danger is in the smoking, is that right?
Correct.
The wax starts smoking, okay.
Right.
Good to know.
So, and that happens around 250 degrees. So if we're staying at 200 or under, we're in really good shape.
Mm-hmm.
The fumes from the wax are very heavy. They stay right at the palate level. Ventilation is really important to have cross ventilation in your studio.
Okay.
Or a box fan in your window, which is close to your palate or where your wax is heating up. But, at, you know, 200 degrees and under, it can be a minor irritant. That's about it.
Okay.
But we're all about the safety.
Oh, definitely, especially if you're doing it as much as you are. For, you know, some of us, it would be maybe once every 6 months or something. The dabblers,
yeah.
You know. But at all times, it's important to pay attention to the safety aspects. That's for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's good. That gives me a little bit, you know, it's not, people get very enthusiastic about trying new things, but I think it's smart that they're aware of what they really need to, before they dive in and all that stuff. So thanks for sharing that with us and me.
I think the book is really explicit. Interweave did a gorgeous job. They're in beautiful, clear, step-by-step photographs. And then also there is a DVD included. And, you know, we all learn differently. So I think for those who like to read directions, you've got the directions and step-by-step photographs. And for those who like to be shown, the DVD is great. And, you know, there are close-up shots of that. And I think it's really, really clear.
Yeah, I think it's excellent that the DVD is included and the price is still very reasonable, too. It's like getting a twofer,
you know?
Yeah,
definitely.
Really.
Definitely.
That's
and then
a great
the cover feels waxy. How did they do that?
I know, it does, doesn't it? I just, you know, I didn't even realize. I kept stroking it, but I didn't know why I was stroking it. But you're right.
It looks just
like a piece. I mean, it is a piece of the artwork on the cover, so it looks, yeah, good point there. That is really cool. I love those little details. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, but
really.
Speaking of the book, though, you, in the, I forget, I guess it was in the front matter, but you wrote about success. And that's one of the questions I always ask my guests, how do you define success as an artist? So when I was reading your book, it jumped out at me that you have this whole section on commitment. And commitment, as you know, is key to success. And I think all successful working artists know that. But for many people, they just give up too soon. So I wanted to know what you have to say about commitment. And another thing that I also stretch with all my clients is working on a schedule. So how do commitment working on a schedule relate to success?
Well, early on, I started working with a friend of mine was becoming a life coach and wanted to practice on me. So we got together and I had some goals about where I wanted to go. I wanted to teach and I wanted to have my studio practice, blah, blah, blah. And what she worked on with me was basically time management. And the time management, we figured out that I have my really good brains in the morning, like my left brain is pretty good in the morning and really stinks in the afternoon. And my right brain, my creative thing, is really going on in the afternoon into the night. And that there has to be exercise in there somewhere. And at the point that I started with her, I was going to the pool every day at noon and doing water exercise. So she had me log my hours just like I was at a regular job. And I had to have, I had to have 15 hours in the studio and 15 hours in the office every week. And then she gave me a day off on Wednesday. And then, you know, it was just like having a regular job. And I got right. into this rhythm of and having a, like a reward by having a Wednesday off. Or I didn't have to work on the weekend, but if I wanted to, I could, you know.
Right.
And because what I want more than anything in my life is time in my studio. I want to be in that zone that I, you know, that where there's no time and there's no space. And I'm in that Robert right. Henri quote where the object isn't to make art, it's to be in that state which makes art inevitable.
Yes,
so
I love
call
that
the zone, you know, like about food, good luck. And the hours are just flying around the clock, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate paperwork. I hate the email. I hate all that stuff that but I have to do it, you know.
Right.
So if I do that in the morning and I go to the pool, then my reward is I get to be in the studio and I don't have to look at my email anymore that day, not until the next morning. So that's in a perfect world, you know, but
right.
I don't get that perfect world very much. But in the beginning, that was how my schedule was put together. And there is a quote about commitment, and it's been attributed to so many people like Goethe, like Sir Hillary, somebody who climbed this mountain, and I don't really know whose it is, but it's something about when you commit to what it is that you want, you put a series of events in motion where every cell in your body is geared to in that direction, and that pretty much heaven or high water or whatever that thing is can't push you out of that dream thing, that goal that you have.
Right.
And so along with that comes a schedule. You have to be accountable. You have to work X number of hours on your right brain. You have to work X number of hours on your left brain. So the other thing is the book Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell, where he says to be successful at something, you have to do it for 10,000 hours. And people who are successful have done something, a practice, over and over and over and over. So I think that's sort of the conglomeration for me about being successful, having a goal, time management, and just practice. And there is this fabulous book called Plain and Simple. Do you know it?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Okay. So in the back of this book, she talks about the Amish. It's like the nine patch. It's in the back of the book. And there is a phrase there, and I know I'm going to blow it, but it's something like, all work is honored. There's no hierarchy of work. As long as you are working, it all kind of goes into the work bank. And so I think about that a lot, too, when I divert or I think, ooh, I'm getting seduced by some new material or I'm not sewing my checks together or, you know, like, ooh, I just want to play with this, that I'm still working and that work is honored and goes into my bank. So did that answer your...
It most definitely does, definitely.
Okay.
So the question that I ask every guest is, how do you define success as an artist? So we know how you create success, but how would you define it?
Oh. I think that for me, being able to teach what I love feels very like success to me, and to have a book out on what I do. When people come up to me and say, I love your work, that feels like success to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily a monetary thing. It's more like a feeling that I have of just puts a big smile on my face. When
right.
people get what I'm explaining in a class, or they take something I've shown them and better it, or show me something that they figured out, that
right.
feels like success to me. When I'm just quiet and cutting out a stencil, or I'm having some precious time with my X-Acto knife and paper, that feels like success to me.
So it's the little things. It's the giving and the rewards from giving, and then the little things that, wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, so next question everyone gets is, where does art come from?
Well, it comes from surrender, I think.
Mm.
And I think it also comes from surrender, letting go, and it's almost like taking dictation. It comes from a place where if I let go, I'm not in charge. And somebody else, it's coming through me. I am a conduit or messenger. You know, I'm not, it's something greater than me, you know, mm-hmm. that I'm not, I don't feel like I'm responsible for. It's just coming through me.
Yeah, I love that.
I don't feel like it's me doing it. I'm just taking mm-hmm. notes, or I'm taking
it's just coming through you. Yeah, that's great. You know, I recently interviewed another artist for the show, Orly Avenari, and she had a very similar answer too. That same thing. She said you have to leave your mind at the door and just come in as whatever it is, but just let it happen. Don't think about it. Let it happen.
I think a part of that is, for me, is the practice of writing morning pages is where you get to see what you're up against with your inner critic. And if you can, you know, if you can ask her to gently leave the studio
mm-hmm.
So that critical voice isn't there, that's another opening. You know, that's a definite success.
Yeah.
When the inner critic is not there with you. So that it's something greater than yourself is, you know, like acting on your behalf, or it's just traveling through you. That's the best I know how to explain it.
No, that's great. Thank you. All right. Well, is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you would like to share with us before we say goodbye?
Hmm. Well, just the things that you can pick up from other people, from students, that the miracles that they can provide you, just to be aware and watch and let the magic happen.
Yeah, I love that phrase, let the magic happen.
Just, you know, by showing what you know, not being afraid to show your technique, show what you know, because nobody's going to do it the way you do it, you know.
Right.
Just freely share information.
Great. All right. Well, I have really enjoyed this. I have learned a lot from you, and there's so much more that you have to give. We'll have to do this again at some other point, too.
Thank you. I am so glad to talk with you, and I hope we can meet someday.
Definitely. It's really hard when you're on one coast and I'm on the other, but I know that we both travel, so hopefully our paths will cross.
Oh, my bad.
Thank you, Danielle. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
All right, I did find the quote that Daniela was alluding to and trying to tell us, and it's one of my favorites. It's one I had on my mirror decades ago that got me started on this path that I'm on, so I do want to share that with you. And it's by Goethe, G-O-E-T-H-E. I learned how to say his name when I had a layover in Germany. So anyway, the quote is, "Until one is committed, there is hesitancy, the chance to draw back. Concerning all acts of initiative and creation, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans. The moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision, raising in one's favor all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance, which no man could have dreamed would have come his way. Whatever you can do or dream you can do, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. Begin it now." And I wanted to share that with you because I know it to be so, so, so very true, okay?
Absolutely.
Okay, you're still there. That's great.
Thank you. Perfect.
All right. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, so thank you all for joining us tonight. And listen again on Monday, September 24th, 2012. When my guest will be craft star, also known as the impatient crafter, Margot Potter. She's coming to us at version 2.0, Margot. So until then, this is Leslie Riley of Artist Success for Art and Soul Radio, reminding you that art is what you make it. Bye-bye.